Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome back to the Des Bishop Podcast. Isn't it wonderful? 2 weeks in a row. When was the last time we achieved that? Anyway, it's great to be back. This week we have a great chat with Stephen Mullen, who is a comedian who's actually been joining me on the road for this second half of the Take the Points tour. And we've gotten to know each other recently. He was a guest on The Shift, which is a very different vibe to this interview in that on The Shift, it was a proper filth fest, and it was great fun. But today, we chat about, well, actually, it was last Saturday on our way to Drogheda in the car, and I wanted to ask him about the story behind his show, Son of a Preacher Man, which he did in Edinburgh this year. And, you know, I didn't know that much about Steve's backstory other than his dad was a preacher, like a born-again preacher, and he grew up with that. And I also knew that at some stage of his life, he had like some sort of breakdown. Those are the only two things I knew. And so I just wanted to kind of ask him, because I haven't seen Son of a Preacher Man, so I wanted to ask him the story behind that show and just a bit about his life. And I have to say, I was taken aback. It was more in depth than I was expecting. I mean, it is a real journey through a troubled childhood and into, I guess you could call the second half of his life, which is, you know, riddled with wonderful achievement, overcoming adversity, and eventually beginning to raise his own family. So this is a chat with Stephen Mullen. And I'll be back on to you after the ep. Well, we're off, Steve.
Yeehaw!
This is one of our driving podcasts. You know,
it's always good fun.
So this is Stephen Mullen, who I guess you're pretty new in the comedy game.
Yeah, I'm certainly new. I mean, I'm new overall. I'm going 3.5 years, but
I'm going three and a half years in,
and even shorter in Ireland because I'm only 2 years in Ireland.
But you've been opening up for me on the on the second half, particularly of this tour.
Uh-huh.
You have your own podcast.
Yep, Hello Steve-O podcast.
The Hello Steve-O podcast, which is also your Instagram.
All the branding.
And I was saying that I wanted to get you on as a regular contributor on the Des Bishop podcast so that we could keep it going. But I thought first we should get to know you a bit, you know?
Yeah. Who is this guy?
Who is this this Stephen Mullen guy? And so here we are. You know, you've got a pretty interesting backstory.
Yeah. It's
I mean, first and foremost, you're raised in Ireland, but was your mother's Portuguese?
My mother is Argentinian.
Oh, Argentinian. Sorry.
It's all the same, Dan.
I get confused.
Yeah, because my partner is Portuguese.
Yes, and you've been on The Shift. When we were talking, you know, you were on The Shift podcast. We're talking about your missus, who's Portuguese. Sorry. So your mother's Argentinian.
Yeah, my mom's from Buenos Aires. Yeah, and so definitely the household was she.
But you grew up in Cork, though, right?
I grew up in Cork. Yeah.
Middleton,
East Cork. I was actually born in Tipperary, in Clonmel, because my dad was living out in the countryside of South Tipperary at the time. He had just brought my mother back from Argentina. They'd just been married, and he was.
Where did they meet?
They met on a ship. They met on a ship. This doesn't sound like anything like Scientology at all now. they both worked on a ship that was spreading the good news of Jesus around the world.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. so sorry, actually, because I was going to ask you,
yeah,
when did your dad become like super Christian? But so they met through Christianity.
Yeah, they met through Christianity. My dad had become a Christian before he'd met my mother. So my dad's background is he's originally from Cove, actually, in Cork, and he left at 16 for the Merchant Navy, and his dad was in the Merchant Navy, so that was kind of
family
in the
tradition.
Family thing, yeah. And as part of his apprenticeship for the college part of it, so you worked away at sea, but for the college part of it, you'd go to Glasgow. So his nautical school was in Glasgow, and he hung out in Glasgow quite a bit, and he just he became good friends with a guy who was a Christian in
like a born again,
yeah, a born again Christian in Glasgow, and that was kind of the beginning of it for my dad. And he, as soon as he finished, so he qualified as a navigator, and he just wanted to get more and more involved in Christian work, essentially. And he joined this crew called OM, Operation Mobilization, who at the time, I don't know, they are still going now, but at the time they had two ships. This is in the 70s, two ships that were traveling the world spreading the good news.
So were they also shipping goods, or it was literally just they were just shipping the good news of the gospel,
shipping Bibles, literally. I'm not even joking, like they would come into ports and be shipping Bibles wherever they went.
So he's just a missionary, straight
exactly,
up
exactly missionary,
a floating missionary,
yeah. And then from my mother's side, so I don't quite know where my dad joined the ship, I can't remember if they were on the
OM?
The OM ship. They're on both ships. One's called the Logos, one's called the Doulos. I don't remember which one they were on, to be honest with you. I think they're on the Logos. But so I don't quite remember or don't know where my dad joined, but my mum had essentially kind of run away from home in Buenos Aires and kind of had enough and just signed up on a whim, and she lived on it for 3 years.
Oh, she lived on an OM ship?
Yeah, for 3 years. Yeah, traveling the world, and she was part of the music group, so she was a good singer, and they would, you know, wherever they landed, you know, there was obviously church going on all the time on the ship, but wherever they landed, they had a music group that could help in people's churches and stuff like that, and it was, yeah, so that's what she did for 3 years, and that's where she met my dad. Yeah.
Wow, that must have been, it's almost like wild, wild country in a way. Like, you feel like you're just sort of stuck on this ship amidst all these people with these similar beliefs. I mean,
similar beliefs and people from all over the world. So it wasn't just, you know, obviously my dad was Irish, my mom was Argentinian, but there was people from all over the world. There was people from Asia, from all over South America, Central America, Europeans. So they're all volunteers. They weren't really getting paid.
And when you ask your dad, because I know you ended up doing the show Son of a Preacher Man, which,
yes,
obviously we're going to talk about different elements of that. But when you talk to your dad nowadays about that time, does he talk about it positively, or does he say it was weird, or it only strengthened his faith? What was the experience for him?
I think for my mom and dad, they hold that time very dearly, very close to their hearts, to be honest with you.
Right, okay. So there was nothing weird about it.
No, it was, you know, I don't think that they would necessarily agree with everything that the belief system or the way that their beliefs were carried out at the time, or that style of being a missionary, you know.
Yes.
But it was of its time, you know.
And yes,
they met each other on the ship. They still have good friends that they keep in contact with. My mom went to Buenos Aires the summer just passed, for a reunion of, I think, 30 years of since a lot of them had joined the ship, or since the last time the ship had been in Buenos Aires, I think. And that was when my mom had joined. So she went back and met, you know, I think there was 40 or 50 people that she was on the ship with at the time. So I think at the time, like, having a faith like that was a really big deal as well. It was a way of getting out of the shitty situation they were, well, certainly my mom, the shitty situation that she was in, you know. She kind of, and she still to this day, I love her very much, but I wouldn't call her the most open-minded of individuals at times.
You think that part of that is the Christian thing?
I think that she's held on to her faith like it's her lifeblood, and that can have negative effects as well, I think.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Because you can't see other angles, you can't see other people's points of view. That is not my mother's strength. My dad would be, it was funny, some of the descriptions of Gay Byrne and his recent passing, and how they said that he was so open-minded and he drove the national conversation forward, and he was quite liberal in that, but in himself he was quite a conservative
man.
Yeah,
that was the description of gay.
Yeah, and I would think of my dad like that as well. You know, he is a very open-minded thinking guy, but in his own personal life I would say he was quite conservative. My mum wouldn't be so open-minded in her thinking.
But in a, you know, maybe, well, who knows why, and it's stupid to guess why, but I guess because in a way she was more saved.
She completely was saved. She wasn't in a particularly nice, she had a really tough upbringing, really tough. She was raised by Italian immigrants. Italian immigrants to Buenos Aires. So my nona had moved to Buenos Aires in the 30s, and they were, you know, they were poor and they had a tough upbringing. But my mum's not their biological kid, and she's actually the daughter of a very poor farmhand in the north of Argentina, and she was just kind of taken down to Buenos Aires on a whim, basically. And this Italian immigrant couple weren't able to have babies, and she kind of got said, "Well, do you want to take this kid?" kind of a thing.
Wow.
And my nona was like, Lord rest her, but she was not nice to my mom, even up as far as, you know, she passed away in 2002, so a while ago now. But like, they were still screaming down the phone to each other, and you know,
and that was her adopted mother.
That was her adopted mother. Yeah, she was a very anxious person, and I think always worrying about stuff like money and all that stuff, as immigrant families were in those times. And but that kind of manifests itself in kind of a weird jealousy for my mom. But she used to like beat the shit out of my mom and stuff like that. And you know, that meant that what my mum's faith meant to her in her own personal life is a very, she clings on to that for dear life.
Sure.
It was her way out, you know?
Yeah, and I guess it brought the opposite of all the shit she hated. It brought safety,
for sure,
focus,
sense
of hope.
Absolutely.
Probably like belonging.
Yeah, you're told that Jesus loves you, you know, no matter what, then you have someone to pray to talk to every time, and then you're part of a community of people that love you as well, you know. For me, it would be difficult to live on a ship, you know. For most people, it would be for 3 years. But, you know, that was she's no siblings, you know, so that was her family, you know.
Yeah. So that's understandable.
Safety. Yeah, for sure.
So your dad, so they came back to Ireland, but when did your dad become a preacher?
They got married in Buenos Aires. They spent a year there, and they were kind of weighing up whether they would live in Argentina or live in Ireland. And my dad had a real, as he would say it, a heart for wanting to be involved in ministry, essentially. And they moved to Ireland, and he basically went to the Irish Bible School at the time, which was in Tipperary, in a place called Colebrook, in the middle of nowhere, in the sticks, like. And he trained there, and that's where, while he was training there to be, I think it was Christian philosophy, I think is what he trained in. That's where my brother and I were born.
Right, and that's, I guess Christian philosophy is basically, how can you turn all of anything that has life, meaning in life, into something from the Bible, right?
Yeah. And so when he moved to Tipperary, he began his studies to become a preacher, essentially. My brother and I were born there at the time, and that was also tough times. My mum tells the story of, there was one point, I think there was no carpet on the floor, and there was no ceiling in the cottage that they were living in and stuff. So that's when me and my brother and I were first living. And my mom always tells the story of when they had 50 pence, and the debate was whether they should buy milk with it or send her a letter to Argentina. and they weren't, because they weren't making money to study or any of that stuff, so they lived off the donations of people, essentially.
Oh, right, okay.
That's how.
So the Christian group are sort of funding their education.
Yeah, and my dad is like, I mean, we were kind of raised on that, really. So then he went to,
and by the way, just before we continue, because I assume you're doing a show about it, your dad's comfortable with you chatting away about him and his
life? Absolutely, man. Yeah. Because the arc story of the show is that my dad is just happy I'm alive, to be honest with you.
Yeah, which we'll get to that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Coming soon, Steve falls apart. But anyway, sorry. So he was in Bible school.
Yes, he was in Bible school, and living off the goodness of others, essentially. He finished that, and he got a job, basically, with the Cork Baptist Church, which was on McCurtain Street, actually. And he used to evangelize in the street a bit as well.
Really?
I forgot to say that in the show last night, but I do remember I couldn't have been more than three. I remember sitting on a crate next to him as he was evangelizing, and he had this whole painting thing, and there was this drunk in the street, And my dad is like, you know, Jesus loves you, and he's walking. My Jesus is a bollocks. Jesus is a fucking bollocks, like. And the drunk fella coming over to me then going, how are you, little fella? He's like, why is he not talking to me? And my dad was like, because he's scared of you. Step back, please.
You actually remember that?
I remember that vividly. I remember a drunk guy coming into the church on McCurtain Street one evening. There was a Sunday evening service going on. And my dad taking him out, bringing him to the chipper a couple of doors down and buying him some chips. And I remember the size of this guy. He was huge. Like, I suppose he was to me as a little kid as well. I probably was 4 or 5 for that one. But he was a big, big, fat guy, long hair. And I remember his poor guy, he's, you know, smelt of urine and whatever else. And my dad, he said, I want ketchup. And my dad going up to the counter. And for a moment, I was just left there sitting at the table eating chips with this homeless guy. But that was the kind of stuff that we had growing up.
So you grew up around that. And
I grew up around that, yeah.
It's pretty normal. You didn't, did it feel normal to you, or were you aware early on that you were like a little strange?
At that stage, there was nothing really. I was just going to play school at that stage. And I went to I did junior infants in Cork City in St. Finbar's in Cork. And then my dad got his first a promotion from Jesus, as I like to say. And he got asked basically to go out to East Cork and to start a church in Middleton. And that's
His own church.
Yes.
But is it Cork Baptist Church?
So that was Baptist at the time. So he was, that's kind of part of an affiliate of Baptist churches around Ireland, essentially. And they're hooked into a crowd called Baptist Missions, who are actually based in Belfast. So it was 1990 when we moved out to Middleton and to an estate there that my dad always says he got the house because it was the cheapest. Again, we didn't have any money, the cheapest he could get, and people calling him and going, you can't raise your family there, it's too dangerous there, you know,
in Middleton.
Well, it's a specific, there's a couple of estates in Middleton, yeah, that are fucking wild. It's hard because they're not the same size as the Glen. They're small, but it's that kind of culture.
Every town has that, yeah, that estate.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's interesting. So your dad is this intelligent Baptist minister, but yet you guys are living in, you know, one of the, you know, that area.
Mm, yeah.
You know, the place that everyone turns their nose up at.
Yeah, and people, as I grew older, like I do make fun of it on stage, but I actually did love it there, but it was tough. You have to be honest about it, and I don't want to.
And did you feel different though? So you're like,
yeah, early days straight away. You knew we were different because they would. I was good friends with the neighbors, but they'd always take the piss out of me. For example, because, you know, my dad had silly things sometimes that now he would go, yeah, that was ridiculous, I shouldn't. But he would say, like, you know, the way kids used to record songs off the radio, and you'd record on your tape. And my dad, but you can't do that, that's piracy and all this, you know. He'd be giving out to them, and it's just like, for fuck's sake. So then I'd get the brunt of that. Oh, you shouldn't be listening to this. Now your fucking dad will kill us and blah, blah, all that kind of stuff.
Right. So your dad's oddities were noticed.
Yeah, straight
and what
away.
Because, I mean, I guess, like, you guys are Protestant, sort of. Not really, like, Protestant.
Protestant extremists.
Yeah, but, like, did you have to deal with that shit?
Of them making fun of us and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, but because the first church building that they had was a play school, which is at the end of our estate, which is a prefab. So we're all down there Sunday morning. Nobody's going to church. Nobody's going to mass these days anymore. Like, no one in the neighborhood went to mass, but they'd hear sing songs and guitars at 11 a.m. on a Sunday morning.
Were there many people showing up at the Middleton Baptist Church?
I think it started off at about like 15, 20 people maybe, and some of those people would have been spread from people that were travelling all the way down to Cork Baptist Church. So they were from Yall, Castle Martyr, Killa, all those areas.
Yes.
So this was like, there's a need for a church out here, so that's why my dad went out to start it.
Oh, okay.
So it was majority. Actually, when it first started.
But he was the preacher.
He was the preacher, yeah. And
like,
he was a young man as well.
What was the energy of your dad's preaching? You know, what was his... Did you impersonate him when you were a teenager and stuff
that? Yeah, yeah. Because he'd do things like, you know, Lord Jesus says, look, and I'm doing a physical thing, you won't see it, but he'd have his hands like a claw when he was trying to make a point, and the cork would really come out with him. I'll never forget one day he was talking about when Jesus went into the market and he didn't like that the Pharisees were selling and making money, but they were using the temple to sell place.
Yeah,
and he's
yeah.
like... But so my dad was telling this story about how Jesus was disgusted at how people weren't doing this. But as my dad is preaching from this bit of the Bible, everyone's nodding off in the fucking, in the congregation. They're all having, you know, it's, they've had a long week. Do you know what I mean? They've heard this story before. A few people are, you know, nodding off slowly but surely. And my dad loses it and kind of says, and Jesus was so angry that he started throwing stuff around the place. And he funks a table across the top of the, across the top of the church. It was guy who'd do stuff like that. And there was one time
so
that
your dad has a strong Cork accent?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, I suppose I don't see it like that, but yeah, everybody
but
says
he does.
But when
he was preaching,
yeah,
he did.
Especially when we were living down there, and he would, he's got a strong Cork temper as well. That's right. For sure, man. He had a fucking temper when we were kids.
And did you guys like sing in there and everything?
Lots of singing. That's the thing about being down in that prefab in the play school. You know, you don't want to get noticed. You don't want to stand out. But all they can hear from the play school on a Sunday morning is, we have decided to follow Jesus. The baptism.
Were your songs completely different?
I've noticed a couple of crossovers because I didn't go to a lot of mass, so I wouldn't know a lot of them. But yeah, completely. Everything at the time was, in that church was hymn books. And then, but yeah,
did you ever get into like the modern Christian shit?
I didn't get into it.
Because I've gone to a few born again churches in Ireland.
Have you? Right.
I have been to a few, yeah. And I, you know, it is a bit like Christian karaoke, but you guys, yeah, I went to a massive one in Dundalk.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But it was very Christian karaoke.
Yeah.
There was screens.
Rock. Yeah.
Well, there was screens
for the
words.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you have all that?
Yeah. You would, yeah, you'd have that. That used to be my job. We used to have to put up on acetates. So I'd have to change it over when the verse changed or scroll it up slowly.
What, on an overhead projector?
On an overhead projector. But if I wasn't paying attention, you'd get a fucking slap in the head. So yeah, I was an acetates boy. I wasn't the altar boy, I was an acetates boy.
Most people are into acid house. You
yeah,
were
exactly.
Acetate,
I was an acetate boy.
Acetate, yeah. Christian rock.
Yeah.
So, okay, so anyway, so... Your entire adolescence then is in this estate, yeah?
Up until 14, I would say, like, so I was from 4 till 14, the whole of the 90s, I was in that estate, which is an interesting time because in my primary school, it was actually okay because I actually went to a Protestant primary school, so it wasn't really...
Oh, you did?
That big of a deal.
Was like the feeder school to Middleton College?
Yeah. St. John the Baptist, yeah.
Okay.
But we did not have the money to be going to Middleton College, yes. So we didn't go there, but we went to the primary school, and it was good, but we were different in every way in the neighborhood, from my mum being a foreigner to us being a different religion. We also went to St. John the Baptist. Nobody went to that school in our neighborhood.
So yeah, these kids, I'd say the majority of them are quite wealthy, right?
They're Protestant wealthy. Yeah, they all had land and stuff like that outside
yes.
of the town.
Yes.
None of them were from the town. And yeah, they're all pretty healthy. Yeah, loads of farmers.
Fucking the Ballymaloe people in there. They're
yes,
Quakers.
Yeah, yeah. The Hydes were there. They were great. We used to babysit the Hydes. They're the ones who started the Ballymaloe relish. So my mum used to babysit one of them. We used to get paid in jars of relish, which was amazing. I'm still addicted to Ballymaloe relish to this day.
No, because I do shows down there. But he was telling me they're Quakers.
Yes, they are Quakers. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
lovely family. And one of the Allens was in sixth class when I just started or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the primary school was actually fine, but we were a bit weird in the estate for going to that school.
Of course, yeah. You're the only prods. You're the only people that give a shit about education.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, it is a good point. I struggled in school now. I got kept back in fifth class, and that was... fucking mortifying.
Really?
Bro, yeah, yeah,
interesting,
mortifying. And I remember I did fifth and sixth class again, and
because there was a lot of shame around the kid that got left back, wasn't there?
It was the worst feeling in the world, when especially when fifth and sixth class were in the same classroom, so they weren't in separate classes. Fifth and sixth were taught together.
Oh god.
So I had to come in the next year, and it was I remember being last into the classroom, and they're like, oh, there's no room for Stephen, and the teacher's like, no, he's sitting over there because he's doing fifth class again.
Oh,
so everybody whose class I was supposed to be in, I just had to sat in the opposite side of the room to him. So that was a mortifying first week or so, that was for sure.
At least you got to stay with your friends, though.
Yeah, for 1 year, and then they were all off into secondary school, and I was doing sixth class again. That was tough. That was fucking...
Yeah, fuck, man.
It was, like, highly embarrassing. I remember my dad bringing...
Was it because of your grades?
Yeah.
Lack of interest?
Yeah, they started me school too young,
or
to be
you
honest with
you. Just fucking tick.
They started me school too young. So I just I was three.
Oh,
turning.
so in actual fact, age-wise, you were fine when you got left back.
Yeah, because I was still young when I went to secondary school after being kept back.
Oh, right. So in actual fact, they put you in too early.
They started me too young. Yeah, I was three turning four when I started primary school.
Yeah, and that can be tough because you know there's a lot of development in a year back at that age.
Big time,
you know?
Big time. But I made it my life's work to finish top of the class and everything when I was repeating it, and get in trouble as much as I could. So I did that. Finished top of the class in fifth class and sixth class. I won.
There you go.
I won all the sports awards and all that.
It was a good move.
It was,
you know, it's literally just like putting a player out on loan.
Yeah.
You know, you're just like, this guy's going to be great, but right now he needs to build up his confidence in League One.
Yeah, yeah. And it was I actually did well once I knuckled down, and I didn't have concentration, and I probably couldn't see it at the time, but I probably was immature in comparison to the other kids.
Yeah, it was a good move. They shouldn't have started you early.
Because I still started secondary school at 12, which is still young enough. Now most people are doing it at 13, you know.
So what happened at 14? You moved?
14, we moved to Dublin.
Oh.
Because he got another job. He got a promotion from Jesus again, and we moved up to Dublin. And I think the issue... tough bit at that point, because I had moved on to secondary school, you know.
Yes.
So I went to the Christian Brothers, which again nobody.
Oh my
went
God!
To.
You switched to a fucking
hardcore other side. But it's because there's no way we were going to Middleton College because we can't afford that, and the community school, the Tech, was where everyone from our estate went. But my mom and dad didn't want me going there, so I went to the Christian Brothers, and I was enjoying it, but I think it was just. It was mayhem again, and after I kind of fell behind straight away in first year, I fell behind again.
Yeah, but it's tough to make a move at that age.
Yeah. I didn't know anybody going to that school. Nobody. So when you went to first year and there's like 150, 200
kids. Where were
kids,
you?
This was in Middleton, in CBS in Middleton.
Oh, sorry, you went to Middleton CBS.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, yeah.
So I went to Middleton CBS but for 2 years, made all my friends there, and then we moved to Dublin. So it was just, it was mayhem. But even at that stage, I was getting into drinking and smoking, and I'd already lost my virginity by the time I was 12.
Oh, so you had the wildness.
The wildness. So there was definitely a sense of, I was already juggling trying to not be getting in trouble at home so much, and be the cool kid outside. So I was wild because I was just trying to fit in all the time.
But it was a normal enough adolescence, like in the wild, but... But you were just a bit of a breakaway teenager. Nothing crazy, right?
Yeah, nothing crazy. Just the.
But then you dropped out of school, right?
I dropped out of school by the end of secondary school. Yeah, yeah.
You never did your leaving.
I didn't do my leaving. Yeah, essentially, and I failed my junior cert.
And what was so?
By the time I was like the moving from Cork to Dublin was huge for me because I was just about. You got to understand that estate. I was keeping people at bay, but like you're only one wrong move away from having the shit kicked out of you. I had the shit kicked out of me a couple of times, but you know, you had to keep everybody at bay.
In Middleton CBS?
In
Dublin.
In,
so where did you go in Dublin?
No, sorry. The shit kicked out of me in the estate in Middleton.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I got you. Yeah.
But in Middleton CBS, it was fine. I was good. I always got away. I was good at sports. I did good at football and did good at, I took up hurling when I went to CBS and I did good at that. So when I moved to Dublin, we moved to Blanchardstown. I went to Coolmine Community School, and that was just it was just a shit show. It was like too much to, I was already juggling too much, you know.
Yes.
Was it
a tough school?
I think it's, apparently it's been a bit considered that now. I wouldn't have considered it tough at the time, not at all. But the year I was in was just a bad year. It was just, and the class I got put into, it was just a bad class. And I don't, like, I'm not to talk derogatory about any of the guys, but there was just a lot of kind of bullying going on in general.
Yeah.
I found the vibe in Dublin at that age completely different. This whole...
Sure.
The loyalty thing was like this streetwise. Being sly to somebody was funny, or being kind of nasty under the, you know, without somebody realizing it was really funny. And that was something that was very different to Cork at the time. There was none of that going on where I had come from.
Right.
Little things like... They used to do this thing in the corridors of the school, like when you're waiting for class, people would stand either side of the corridor on either side of the hall. And they would throw bits of rubbish or crumbs or whatever on the floor. And if you stepped on it while you were walking through that you didn't even know what this was, they'd kick the living shit out of you. They'd just fucking boot the shit out. So that kind of, there was lots of sly little things going on. People who, you're trying to make friends all the time, but it was hard to fit in. Obviously, you're the culture then in that situation as well.
Yeah, you're a culture all of a
you're
sudden.
You're a fucking culture, yeah. So you're, you know, they're all taking the mickey out of it. So I only lasted a year in that school. And it was just a disaster. And then I moved to Cabra, a school in Cabra, which was actually great.
Right.
I think
but the still a lot of transitions for a young guy.
Yeah. At that stage, I think that was my fifth or sixth school by the time I was 15. And moved into and living in Dublin and Cork, and I wasn't fitting in. And also, meanwhile, the whole time I'm trying to hide that my dad is a born again Christian preacher.
Oh, right.
Because that was material for people. That was the fucking bullying.
Oh, so you kept that on the down low.
I kept that on that. From secondary school, going to secondary school in Middleton, for whatever reason, I knew people can't find out about A, the estate that I come from, and B, that my dad's a preacher.
Right.
Because he used to laugh at the estate.
Right, so you're carrying around a lot of... Yeah. You're really carrying around a lot of shame. Yeah. You're really feeling like there's something wrong with you, really.
For sure. And not telling my parents that I'm having sex.
Yes. But that's more universal.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But you don't realize that at the time, you know.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So you're really carrying around a lot of junk.
Yeah, yeah.
Which culminates in you fucking leaving school.
Kind of, yeah. It culminates in me leaving the school, and the first school in Dublin, going into the second school, and kind of feeling that, well, what happened in the first school was it wasn't a great year, as I was saying.
Yes.
But I did the junior cert, and I failed it. Like, who fails the junior cert? But I literally, at that stage, I had not done a tap of work for the whole of secondary school because I was constantly missing school, didn't want to go because, you know, I found an old, actually, you know the diaries that you have to write down your homework that they give you in school? I found one of those recently, fucking sick notes every week, just not going in. And I was signing them myself as well and shit like that.
But I get that, bro. I had the exact same experience. Yeah. My first year in school in America, a couple of groups turned on me.
Right, yes.
And the stress of that, I just completely withdrew from school. And I spent most of my time trying to avoid doing homework. I remember I started to get in trouble, like, in terms of my academics.
Yes.
So then suddenly my mother was, like, putting me under pressure to do my homework. But I was also fucking tired at night. And so she'd have me sitting there, and then I would go to the bathroom.
Right.
And I would sleep in the bath. And then eventually she'd notice, she'd be like, Desmond, I'm like, I'm just in the bathroom. But I'd be like, had been asleep for half an hour in the bath. Because I just
the
didn't.
The fucking stress of that.
Yeah, I couldn't deal with fucking doing the, at that time, yeah. I couldn't deal with doing the work.
But there's too much stress going on in your life at that age. Like,
it's too much to deal with.
It's too much to deal with. You can't be sitting down doing fucking algebra then, you know? It's just
And nobody talked about bullying, and nobody talked about anxiety.
No. I was like, I remember, because I was in therapy. I was with a therapist for a while. Later on in my life. And he said to me, yeah, not everybody wets the bed till they're 14, Stephen. And I just realized, you know, I had to go, oh, fuck, right, yeah. So that was an issue, you know. I was pissing the bed in secondary school.
Oh, right, so you really had a lot going on.
I was, and... It was embarrassing, but I was like, there was also times that
well, I was doing that too, but only in blackouts.
Right, yeah, but that was an issue because I think I was just fucking nonstop anxious about stuff all day.
Sure.
Also, like, when we were living at home, like, my mom, by her own admission, right, says that she was not a good mother, and I got the brunt of a lot of that because I'm the eldest. But she would be fucking stressing and about money all the time. So if I went out and played football and fell over and ripped my tracksuit bottoms that we just gotten done stores, it's fucking war at home. Do you know what I mean? Because we don't have the money, the credit card bill, blah, 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 blah. And I'm hearing about the budget all the time, the household budget.
Yes.
And part of a lot of the stuff that she would have gone through as a child, she started doing to me.
Yeah,
you know,
she passed it on to
so,
you.
Yeah, so she starts beating the shit out of me all the time at a certain point. My dad starts to do it as well, which is, I look back on and go, that's not very holy.
Yes.
You know what I mean? But these are all part of my life. And I used to piss the bed all the time. And I remember one night in particular being in the bath in Middleton after, you know, trying to wash myself after having pissed the bed again. And my dad was so angry, he threw the pissed stained sheets at me, like, jeez, in the bath. And I was like, fucking hell, I'm useless. So even at that age, that sense of, like, I'm fucking useless.
And how do your parents feel about... Because obviously now you're speaking so publicly about this.
Yeah, I haven't said that one now.
Oh, right.
No,
I know, but how do they...
I don't know.
You've obviously talked to them about the fact that it was too stressful as a child.
No, I've never have.
Oh, you haven't?
No, I never have. And we haven't... Because of how dark things got by the time I was 17, 18, 19... there was so much that happened at that time that it was so extreme that I think for a good 10 years after that, all of my family held a lot of shit against me.
Oh, against you?
Yeah, because I became a very... I had the drug abuse issues became so that I was a very violent person, very argumentative person, and alcohol as issues as well, it just led to it being a very volatile home, very violent home, when we were in Dublin, after I'd moved to Dublin. So for whatever reason, that the conclusion of it was, we kind of, let's just fucking carry on and not talk about it, I think, kind of a thing.
Right.
I mean, my dad only found out years afterwards that I was getting high in my room all the time, you know. After I was in my early 20s, I went on to work with charities with people with drug issues and drug abuse issues in their lives, and I had a panic attack one day in work because I was doing a key working session with a guy, and he had a slip up. He was a heroin user. He had a slip up, and he was telling me about the time he shot up, and what it felt like and all that stuff, and I had to fucking recoil into a bathroom having a panic attack because it felt exactly what he was going through. Mentally, what he was going through was exactly what I used to do every night when I was getting high in my room. Just this whole space of being so fucking down, but planning and pre-planning.
Yes.
And just, you know, that you're just looking to just fuck get out, literally.
So
get
when did
out
you become
head.
Aware that you had like a drug problem?
Probably not till honestly, not till a year after I was in therapy and I had stopped everything. But
oh, so let's back up.
Yeah, yeah. So what happened was, when I went to the second school in Dublin after having finished
in Cabra
after I'd failed my junior cert, I went to this other school, and that school was great for me because there was at least it took away one tension because it was all boys, and I felt that in the other school with the girls thing, I was popular with the girls, but the lads would hold that against me as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a never ending, so that tension was gone. There's no girls around, so that tension is gone, and I was good at hurling, and you know, I was on the same team as Bernard Brogan and Mick Carton and Alan Nolan, all these guys who went on to play for Dublin.
Yes.
For years and won All Ireland medals and all that. So that particular team, we won a lot of medals, so I felt good, I felt part of something, but the academics was not happening because at that stage I'd been 3 or 4 years in secondary school and I have not done anything. I have not applied any work at all.
Yeah.
And it just so happened I was starting to drink a lot, and that was part of the GAA culture as well. You'd have a match and
yeah, but you're just a normal Irish teenager.
Yeah, normal Irish kid, but I was getting drunk because I needed to get drunk from a very young age.
Sure, I completely identify with that.
And so then I just got pulled out of class one day, man, and they apparently had noticed that there was something wrong with me. The teachers were worried about me. And the principal pulled me out of class one day and he said, look, the teachers are worried about you, and your mother's actually called as well, and she's worried about you. And this guy, Lord rest him, I heard he passed away recently, Jack Cleary. He was a lovely principal and a great man, and he was really good to me because he could see I was struggling with stuff.
Yes.
He sent me up to the school counsellor, and she asked me a few questions and stuff, and she said that I was suffering from depression, and have you ever heard of this? And I was like, nah, I have no clue what you're talking about. She said, well, your dad's going to come and collect you now. And I think I was just unmotivated. And I know at that time, while the hurling was going good and stuff like that, I didn't see what I was going to be doing with my life. I didn't see where I was going. School finishes. I remember me and another lad looking at each other. One of the teachers said, no leaving cert, no life. And the two of us looking at each other knowing that
we're fucked.
We're not getting a fucking leaving cert. And we had no idea what we were going to be doing. So my dad picked me up that day after the day with the counsellor, brought me down to a doctor, and he started me on tablets, and that was...
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I went straight to that.
And it was literally just from a counsellor saying, I think you're depressed.
Well, I assume, I don't know, we haven't gone back into it, but evidently a lot of people have been talking about me behind my back.
Right.
And hadn't come and talked to me, so my parents were worried, and they brought me to this guy who was apparently a specialist in this area, and he was a family friend of one of the guys in the church, and he was good with this kind of thing, apparently. And he was the guy to go see, and he just started me on antidepressants, and that was a good...
But you, were you personally at that time aware that you were feeling like a blackness or a...
I don't think I did, no. I don't think I had much hope, maybe.
Yeah.
And I was I was still in the firing
line. But were you suicidal?
Not at that point, no.
Right.
No way, no, no. No, I wasn't...
Never the answer you want when you ask somebody, were you suicidal? Not at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
That comes later in the story.
yeah, it does. No, at that point, no, I wasn't. And on paper, apart from academically, things were going well. My family life definitely wasn't great.
And were you surprised then when they were like, you need to get the tablets?
I kind of felt... To be honest with you, I do remember feeling a sense of relief, kind of going, oh, there's something that's wrong with me, so
okay.
I'll get sick. And I'll get better, sorry. And I took it as like, well, I'm sick, so these are going to make me better.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a girlfriend at the time, and I remember explaining it to her, and she's like, yeah, cool, that's totally cool. But I think what, unbeknownst to everyone, nobody monitored my intake of these tablets. And every time I would just go back, and he would just up and say, how are you feeling? Well, not great, to be honest with you. And he would just up the dosage.
And were you aware that you were actually scheming the system? Were you starting to get into...
No, not at all at this point. But because they just kept... the more and more I would say I'm... I think the diagnosis probably... Well, their diagnosis probably stressed me out even more. And nobody was monitoring my intake of these tablets. And what I know now is you cannot fuck around with these tablets. You have to take them every day. You can't be skipping them. You have to respect what they do. Same with sleeping tablets. I started on sleeping tablets, started getting them off my dad first, and then...
They were giving you sleeping tablets?
Well, he said, if you can't sleep, I have a tablet, whatever. And then the doctor started giving me sleeping tablets. And every time I would go back and say, no, I'm not better, they would just up it until a point that they wouldn't give me any more, because they're like, well, this is as high as you can go. So then they would just switch the... They would switch the... Not the brand or the type of antidepressant that I was on. And in the meantime, while all this is going on, the youth groups of the church that I'm in Dublin, the leaders are coming and having chats at me and saying, they're literally trying to pull out of me, kind of, what is it that you've done? Because there's something that you've done that makes you feel this way, kind of thing, you know?
Oh, right. So they're just making an assumption that there's some sort of...
Yeah, that I've fucked up or that...
Shame.
That I've got some shame that I have to let out, and that's why I'm feeling this way, blah, blah, blah. So I'm dealing with that. I'll never forget one, God bless him, an American dude is like, man, you can tell me whatever, I've heard it all, don't be worrying about it, and started telling me about his marital issues to try and like be on the same level.
Oh yeah, he's trying to get you to come.
Trying to get me, and he's talking to me about wanking and all this stuff, and I'm like, this is going to be the worst TJ Fridays ever.
Well, he's talking, saying that he's feeling bad about wanking.
Yeah, watching porn. I'm like, you're a fucking weirdo.
You know, I don't know what it is, but I'm always so unlucky in Ireland. I always end up behind the car that doesn't have their fucking money ready.
Yeah, it seems to happen to me a lot
at
as well.
The toll. Maybe it just...
I mean, they don't even
lot.
Seem to be looking for the money in front. Oh, here we go.
Well, it's
now,
a very small basket.
Now
here
you can't
at
reach.
The Drogheda slam dunk, baby.
Well done. That was a good dunk, to be fair.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. So this guy. Anyway, long story short, that certainly wasn't what was driving you. You know, like you, it wasn't. They were wrong to be thinking that.
Yeah, I think that the
well, probably the, what they should have been saying was, you know, was there some fucked up shit in your childhood?
Yeah, and because the people that you want, I remember my poor dad kind of saying, well, one stage kind of going, look, if there's anything you ever want to talk about, I'm going to leave a jar here and you can write it down and you can put it in whenever you want.
Oh, that was cool.
And he was really trying, but I knew it was like, I'm never going to do that, Dad. I'm never going to be able to tell you about the things that I've done because we don't have that relationship.
Yes,
here, you know?
Yeah.
That trust is, you're told like we love you no matter what, but if you don't go to church on Sundays, you know, you're made to feel bad about it and blah, 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 blah. So at that stage, by the time I'm starting on the pills, let's not forget I'm getting very drunk on a regular basis,
right,
before these pills have started. So that cocktail is not good.
Not a good mix.
I mean, as soon as I moved to Dublin, I found out where the fuck, who was drinking. And we used to go down, we used to go watch Bohemians every week or every second week and get all absolutely off our tits and go in there at 14, 15 years of age, hammered to the match, look for a fight or whatever, blah, 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 blah. And I'd be hung over half the time probably, you know. So I was getting drunk a lot. So by the time I start these antidepressants, I'm getting drunk and missing the antidepressants and moving the medications around and changing them, and I'm not respecting it. So the mood swings start to become really...
Oh, really?
Really up and down. And
so you start to really get into some mental health shit.
Yeah, so then you realize, so then the depression starts to become rage. There was like all sorts of episodes of like, I didn't talk for a few days at one point. Literally, and I still can't explain that now. I don't know why. I don't know what was going on, but I would not talk to him. You could be screaming in my face and I wouldn't open my mouth. And that happened in my girlfriend's house at the time. My dad came to take me home and took me away for a few days. And I ran away a few times and didn't tell anybody. And I started to... drinking was definitely my...
The big one.
My out, you know. That was... I needed to... That was the only way I was going to be able to express myself at all. And then... This genuinely happened. Over the course of a couple of years, all these mood swings start to become a lot worse. I become very violent. Like, I smashed up the house at one point, that there was a lot of plaster work done on the walls in our house and new doors hung and stuff like that. And I attacked my dad a few times. And
oh, really?
He would
really
have attacked me as well.
So nice chaos.
Yeah, a nice bit of chaos going on there.
should have been back in the Middleton estate. It would have just been normal.
Yeah, I was thinking, do you know what? We saw where I'm living now. Anyway, yeah, you'd hear quite regularly people beating the shit out of each other after a few drinks on the way home on a Sunday night, you know? I mean, it was awful. But yeah, all that shit was going on. And the irony of it being that we were trying to be the Christian family in the neighborhood, but all that shit was happening in our house as well, you know?
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah.
So, I haven't seen Son of a Preacher Man, but I know it ends up with you being in a mental institution.
That's the what do they call the end of the third act? Because yes. It gets happy after that. So I do, yeah. I ended up in psychiatric, in Blanche, basically.
Oh, you did. And how old were you?
I can't. It's embarrassing, but I can't remember. I think I was 17, maybe 18. 2004 is a year I don't really remember very well.
Oh, so you were a teenager?
Yeah, I was a teenager, yeah. And I can't even remember. I think I'd dropped out of school at that point and I was working as an apprentice carpenter. But the worst bit started before getting suicidal was I started getting high all the time. I'd seen a movie where a guy gets a load of tablets from his... he just had a load of tablets and just would crush them up and put them into a brandy glass and drink them, and that's how he got high in his hotel room.
And what was the what were the tablets?
I don't know what he had, but what I would do was I'd make cocktails of antidepressants, paracetamols, Nurofen Plus, sleeping tablets. Sleeping tablets were great for getting high. That's what you see a lot of people around Dublin now. They're on relaxers, D5s and D10s and all that. That's what they're high on, because if you take these and you stay awake, you're on this weird...
Yeah, you're nice and smooth.
Yeah, exactly. So I used to do that all the time, but I would mix it with whiskey and brandy and shit like that and just be in my room and write and just stare at the wall. And like, I was just high. I used to love...
Basically, William Burroughs.
Yeah, man. I used to love writing and falling asleep on the page because I was so high, and wake up the next morning and see the scrawl and just, you know, that's
what I... Drugstore cowboy.
Yeah.
All right. So you really were, you know, essentially you were, you know, pretty deep into addiction.
Yeah. And then certainly drug abuse. And because I did manage to stop, and I can drink now. I don't like it. I don't like being drunk, but I can drink. And it's not
well,
a big
that's
deal.
Neither here nor there. That's not important.
But anyway, I ended up in. I can't quite remember what the incident was, but I've had a couple of overdose incidents where I know one time I'd lost a lot of blood because I'd basically hacked open my arm and.
What?
Yeah, I'd hacked open my arm with a bread knife. That's one of the jokes in the show.
Ha ha ha.
Yeah, well, no. Well, the joke is I hacked open my arm open with a bread knife. My mother comes in to find me and goes, "Oh no, not my good bread knife."
She did not.
No, she didn't.
But that's the joke in the show.
That's the joke in the show, you know.
The secret out of the bag.
Yeah, and I ended up in a psychiatric. I went to see I don't know how many psychologists that day, five or six, and they're like, "Yeah, you have to stay. You have to stay. You have to stay." And because the GP had sent me, and my dad brought me down, and then I decided, like, I was there for a few hours, they tagged me up, I had the bed, and then I was like, not a fucking hope, I'm not staying here, I was freaking out. So they brought him back in, and they were trying to get him to sign me in.
He didn't commit
and
you?
He didn't, and I fucking legged it that day. And I don't remember if it was after that or after another incident, exactly, but there was some incident like that where I got up one morning and decided I was not drinking anymore and not taking tablets anymore, and I just did it, and fuck me was I sick for months after that, like cold turkey.
You had the cold turkey
big time.
So you never detoxed?
No, and it was like, you don't reckon that's, it's not it's highly unrecommended. It's very dangerous to do that, even off alcohol if you're an alcoholic.
No, alcohol is worse than heroin.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's what the therapist told me. He worked with heroin addicts.
Well, because heroin withdrawals won't kill you, but alcohol withdrawals
physical.
Can kill
you. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so I had come off, I just stopped, and I remember being very fucking sick, like working on building sites and not being able to lift shit and getting in trouble because I wasn't working hard, but I couldn't fucking move, man. I remember after a football match one day, I wasn't playing, but I went down to meet the lads in the pub afterwards, and I was just fucking in this state on the couch in the pub, just like drooling and not being able to,
really?
And sweating, and
Jesus.
I didn't find out till a year later that was cold turkey, basically.
Oh, so you didn't even know that you were withdrawing?
No. So all this getting high, and like, nobody knows about this. This is all on its own. And I started to tell the therapist exactly what it was, and he explained to me, well, that's you know, that's withdrawal symptoms, and that's you're feeling
and you
sick
did that without any support groups or anything.
Nothing. I became good friends with some guys that were in Cool Mine at the time, you know, Cool Mine.
Yeah,
Lodge.
Sure. I was gonna say, was actually gonna make a joke earlier that you're in the right place to get fucked up
exactly,
on drugs,
because
you can just go next door to sort your shit out.
Well, I made some good friends, and I was so jealous of them because they all had each other and they all had groups.
Yeah, but they also had the day top theory, which was it's kind of a disproven theory nowadays. But
okay.
Cool Mine has moved on, but
right.
there was a time where they were using a little bit of a sort of a dated theory, which was for Vietnam vets coming back from Vietnam, you know. It was very confrontational,
yes.
very sort of militant, you know. But anyway, I believe that I believe it's a lot better nowadays, you know.
Yeah, but I was like, there's a couple of guys that were actually, unfortunately, saw one of them recently. He was on the street there.
Oh, he's back out there. Yeah, that's the tough part, you know. So anyway, but that was good that you had those guys. So they tell you about, like, you need to fucking...
I was well on the road to recovery at that point, but when I had met them, I was like, for years afterwards, I didn't have much of a personality. I would not go into social situations. I would not fucking go to a pub where there was groups of people, and became, like, I definitely... In school, you see, I was a messer, I was a cheeky fucker, a bit of personality, and that was what fed into the getting high and the drinking and all that. It's like, it's all fuel for the character that I'm keeping up to stop people laughing at me, you know?
Yeah.
After you stop taking everything, I was left with no friends. My dad had tried to kick me out a couple of times, and I was just about allowed to be in the family home. And I had a job, and that was my life. That was it, really.
Yeah, but that is a tough transition. And it's a tough transition for everybody who decides, you know, I mean, no matter how long the abuse goes on of alcohol or drugs, you know, and sometimes it's longer than others, but it's a tough transition to think, well, what do I have in my life now? You know, you've kind of lost your best friend. Yeah,
yeah.
You've lost your identity. You've lost your, you know, everything that you do. So that's really difficult. And that's what's great about, like, support groups, and you didn't have that.
Yeah, no, there was no one to, because I didn't even know what I was doing, you know. I didn't even know that I was that, like, if I had met that therapist earlier on, he would have, and I was honest with people, because...
So where did the therapist kick in?
I remember my mum making the rules. I'd gone to see a few counsellors, and it didn't work out because they were Christian counsellors, and then this guy was cool, he made me laugh, and he was taking the piss out of me all the time, and he was an alcoholic himself, and he was like, you think you're mad, I'm fucking mad, you know.
Sober alcoholic, or?
Yeah, sober, but he still did the meetings and stuff.
Oh yeah, what was
like,
his name?
He was
I might know him.
Well, you don't know, he unfortunately passed away recently, but he had a great name, the legendary Sean McDermott.
All right, that name is actually familiar to me.
Still know his phone number off by heart.
All right. The fucking bat phone.
yeah, exactly. But I lived for Fridays at 6 o'clock. My dad gave us his office in Blanchardstown at the time, and we would meet there, and it was just like, it was genuinely a godsend to me, and that was the first time I got to, you know, be honest and express, and I never told him about, like, the sex and stuff like that, because I was still ashamed of all that shit, but, you know, he knew, and, you know, I knew he wouldn't judge me anyway if I did.
But the sex was just normal, right?
Yeah, well, yeah.
But you had this Christian shit going on.
Yeah, I did, yeah. I had this the Christian shame shit going on, and there was, like, Middleton was going through a really bad time, after we moved, like, the suicide rate had went through the roof.
Yeah, that's right. For a while, it had the highest suicide rate in Ireland.
That's right. In Europe at one point, apparently.
Yeah, so I remember that story, yeah.
So I was losing loads of mates like that, and then there was, you know, then I was going through my shit in Dublin. My old football coach got done for molesting kids, and, you know, it was just a fucking bleak time.
How the fuck did you get into comedy? you know, I'll tell you what the problem with you is. You're the fucker that's reinforcing the stereotype that comedians are just sad fuckers.
But I don't see myself like that at all. Like,
I'm kidding.
I don't.
You're in a safe space here now.
I did, because I, like, if you were to meet my teachers in school now, like, oh, he was a messer. You know, I was always getting kicked out of class, like, for making jokes and shit like that. Are we here? Are we?
I think we're close, but it should be right around here. But
Bridge clubs of Drogheda are brilliant.
Yeah, I plan to park and continue this conversation.
Absolutely.
I'll worry about where the venue is now in a sec.
But we're in the general facility.
Well, we'll see. Facility, I mean, it's kind of a bit of an industrial area, to be honest.
It's like old school industrial as well, though.
Yeah. It's to be honest, your parents contacted me, and You're being committed.
We're signing you in.
I didn't want to tell you until right. Yeah, yeah.
Your parents contacted me. Your teachers contacted me. Your missus has contacted me.
The facade is up.
Your daughter has contacted
me. We're aware
me.
That you've been crunching up tablets. And this whole comedy thing is a fraud. All right, so where does Son of a Preacher Man go then?
Son of a Preacher Man as a show starts starts in Cork in the council estate. And the, you know, just the general.
But where does it go from what we know already?
From
what we know from this conversation is what I mean.
So the end of the third act is the psychiatric ward and getting out of there and meeting the therapist. And it goes into the comedy then of my life on building sites and moving to London. So you do skip a good 10 years there, but right. Moving to London and meeting my now girlfriend and the mother of my.
Your child,
my daughter.
A happy ending.
Yeah, and it goes into all that.
Can you remember any like nuggets that Sean McDermott told you that like really stuck for you?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
He never said it, but what he was always teaching me was not to take myself so seriously.
Right.
He never used those words because he would never have done that because I would have been too sensitive to take that. But what he was always teaching me was, like, over the 2-3 years that I went to see him, was not to take yourself so seriously. And
do you think that was almost like a try to, like don't be self-centered? Not self-centered because it sounds negative, but I guess there is an element of you know, you need to break free from your head.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, just that the more and more we talked about everything, the more and more he talked about that's normal. You know, he normalized everything. That's
right.
Of course you're upset about that, yeah. And that's okay, but you're good at this and you're good at that and, you know, you don't live in that.
And did he ever get into, you know, the stuff in your history that might have been driving that?
No, he didn't. And I think I was grateful for that. I think you could probably, if I was to go again, you could probably go and find a load of other shit in there about that. And but no, he was very much of, in a lot of ways, he was a lot more like a life coach because he was taking what we have here now, what are the good things that you have here, and how do we move forward from there? Like the transition from where I went in my first year with him, I had just come out of a psychiatric ward. I was probably on the verge of getting sacked out of my job. I was getting high all the time and I had massive scars up my arm because of doing damage to myself. And I like had dependency issues on drugs, right? To a year later, having come back, gone into the second year of my apprenticeship, and I was playing League of Ireland football.
Were you?
Completely sober. I was I didn't have the girlfriend at the time, but I'd managed to gather something together, and he was so proud of me, and I was so thankful to him because he actually gave me the connections in football to be able to progress in that, and I kind of got a bit of a clean slate. I got a bit of a clean start. I moved football teams. I went to somewhere that nobody knew me. I was a young kid on the team, and the lads looked up to me. I think the manager had a son who had gone through this similar kind of stuff, so he knew what was going on. Never
Oh, really?
Asked me about it. And I said to him the first day after training, the manager said to me after the training session, he's like, "Well, Stephen, we'd like to sign you. So Sean sent you down," and I immediately went, "Yeah, I'm not on drugs anymore." Oh. And he said, "I don't care what you're doing. You're here to play football, and that's all that matters. So we'd like you to sign." And I knew I had a clean slate. I didn't have to talk about anything. I was very quiet in that dressing room. You know, the lads were, I was 18, 17, 18 at that time. The lads were all 27, 28 and up. So it was senior football. So I was the baby. I was getting looked after, you know. And it was just a clean slate. And I went from that team on to play for in a little bit of League of Ireland under 21s. And but Sean taught me to not take myself so seriously. And I probably, looking back at that now, I was quite a driven person, you know. So
yes,
to go from that one extreme to the other, I think I still do have a bit of a chip on my shoulder that I got to prove myself to people, you know. For years afterwards, I was going on dates, going, having to explain to the girl at the start, you know, I don't drink because, blah, 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 and telling them everything. Yeah. Just like, Jesus Christ, you don't need to do that. They don't need to know, you know.
And do you ever have any resentment that, you know, for all the ability and potential that you had, I mean, you weren't given the ultimate template to blossom.
No, I don't hold resentment about it, but I definitely have a chip on my shoulder about it. Yeah, for sure. Like I got into acting in my mid-20s, and I even struggled in that field because everybody knew everybody because they'd done 4 or 5 years in Dramsock or whatever university they went to. I did a gig in UCD recently, actually, for their Freshers Ball. And as a 34-year-old man, I was so jealous of, like, fuck me, this would have been great.
Right, yeah.
So I feel that, you know.
Yes. I
feel like I would have liked to have gone through that, and I would have liked to have been part of something where I could have developed along with a bunch of other people, my peers or whatever like that, you know.
Sure.
But at the same time, I do realize that it has given me, the things that I've gone through has given me the ability to, you know, to express myself in the arts. I was never involved in the arts, but I had a band for a couple of years and I sang and I wrote the songs, and then I got into acting. And the reason I got into acting was because of all the stuff I'd been through. I was able to pretend to be a drug addict in the play. That was easy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but you had a natural talent too. I mean,
for sure.
You gravitate towards the things that you know. There must have been some other focuses, you know, there must have been some other things driving you towards that, you know?
And just want you know, I definitely have lived a life since getting through that part of my life of wanting to be successful for myself, because I've never felt successful at anything that I've done, do you know what I mean? So you kind of want to...
Well, you don't want to lose, you don't want to get too content.
No.
Because then, you know, you lose a little bit of your drive. But then at the
Well,
you don't want the irrational drive that is unquenchable.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, can leave you a bit empty at the end of it all.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's good to... I mean, I've never known a life without dysfunction, but I just think it would be awful to have none at all.
What would you talk about on stage?
Like, even just like, you know, what would push you, you know?
Yeah.
What would keep you fucking ticking over?
What would light the fire?
But really just... That's the wounded man's philosophy, because, you know, somebody who's never truly known absolute peace will always think life would be shit if you were just happy.
Yeah, it would. Yeah,
well, I mean, I'm kidding, of course.
I definitely have a different perspective on things that I would like. Yeah, you're supposed to go. You're not. I don't believe you're supposed to be happy in life either. Do you know what I mean?
I think you're meant to be all things.
Yeah.
You know, all things. You can't be just... Happiness is not a goal. Happiness is one of the many things
that happens.
That happens throughout your life.
For sure. And I've learned so much. Like, I've been able to do so many things. Like the work I did with the charity that I worked with for a couple of years, you know. I was only able to do that because of where I grew up and the kind of family I grew up in. We were good with people. We always met people from around the world all the time because of being in a church. So I was good at talking to people from all backgrounds in life. And then the struggles that I had been through, it meant that I was really good at the charity work as well.
Yeah. Know? Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, it makes you who you are.
Yeah, for sure, man.
You know, I mean, there's part of me that's like annoyed that I was allowed to come to Ireland when I was 14. Like, I probably shouldn't have been here on my own, sort of semi looking after myself. But then on the flip side, it's like, I'd hate to be the Dez that didn't come to Ireland at 14 and doesn't know about both cultures. And, you know, like,
It's
like, you take the good with the bad.
But you've had a completely other kind of life. It's crazy.
100%, But you take the good with the bad, and you never know. I mean, I love these people say, I look back on my life, and, you know, I have no regrets. And I think, well, okay, I can understand the sense of having no regret, but who can look back on their life and not think, wow, there could have been some stuff that was better?
Yeah, for sure. Like, obviously.
Just, it's only natural. It can't totally be perfect. Natural. You only get one go, and sometimes you're going to make mistakes. Now, I get it. You don't regret those mistakes, but at the same time, it's hard not to look back and think like, oh, there would have been so many better scenarios.
Yeah.
But I'm content with where I am today, you know?
Yeah.
I think some people like to look on the past with rose-tinted glass. I don't mean that in a defeatist way. I just think people are afraid. I think sometimes people are like, it's not okay to be like, you know what? I would have preferred if my mother was calm.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah, you
know,
definitely.
I would have preferred if I, you know, had more awareness of where I wanted my comedy to go in 2004. Yeah, you have any very regrets about your career? No, I have no regrets about my career. I made perfect decisions every fucking step of the way. Yeah, right. You're fucking full of shit.
Yeah. And you're going to learn by making mistakes, man.
I mean, since we're going to have you on the podcast more, I think maybe we'll just leave it there. But the last thing I wanted to say is, you know, there's a lot to... It's a lot to deal with. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about your mom some other time.
For sure.
I love those mom conversations. But do you ever think that for a guy that's been through so much mental health stuff and stuff with drugs, stand-up comedy is like, it's not the most stable place.
The
emotionally
industry.
And mentally.
Yeah. No, yeah, for sure.
Do you ever wonder if you ended up here, for bad reasons?
No, I'm not that, like, I'm not emotionally attached to that stuff anymore.
Right.
And I'm very much aware of I'm very focused in this, and I'm very, but also completely realistic as well. And kind
yes.
of going, you know, these are the pitfalls, these are the challenges that you're up against. And I'm very motivated. And I mean, that is the end of Son of a Preacher, man. I'm motivated because, again, another literally a mistake in my life, but an unplanned pregnancy after meeting somebody after 7 months. And we're still working at it. And, you know, we have an amazing daughter and we have a home in Dublin and we're very grateful for that. But that stuff gives me focus because I'm not,
yes.
you know, I'm not fucking about anymore. You know, I'm not going to work every evening just for a jolly or to have a few pints or to, you know, I'm not chasing some ladies or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's because it's like, you know, this is what I'm at now, and I don't have a degree to fall back on or anything like that. You know? I don't have my junior cert to fall back on now. So I got to fucking crack on, you know. It isn't necessarily the most stable thing, but like I definitely wouldn't change, you know. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But, you know, you give it fucking everything. Why not leave it all out on the floor, man? You know?
And it's good to be passionate about something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love the industry, and I do love the for me, it comes back to exactly when I first started writing songs. The first songs I was writing were the most depressing fucking things ever because of where it was. But when we got the band going and some of the stuff I was writing about then and the inspiration that I had from various writers was just like, you're just singing about dreams, about things that you know think are it's a great idea or, you know, inspirational stuff. And stand-up comedy for me gives you that same thing, that you write something, you go and you give it to the people straight away. You go and you do it. There's no fucking about. You're not waiting for anybody in between. You go and you fucking do it. That was my struggle with acting, is that you have to wait for other people to get involved,
yes.
audition, blah, blah, blah. You write a song, you go sing it. You write a joke, you go do it.
You go perform it, yeah. That's one of the great things about stand-up.
Yeah.
Just can't guarantee. You write a joke, you go do it, and you get paid. The last part is not the guarantee.
Not the guarantee, yeah, for sure.
All right, well, listen, we got to fucking go do a show.
We got to do some work,
We're
bro.
We're in Drada. We got to find this fucking venue because I've never played it before. And sure, if we decide we want to add more, we can do it on the way back, or we can just leave it until the next time.
Until the next time, yeah.
Either way, it was great chatting to you.
Thanks, bro. Pleasure as always.
So thanks. Thanks to Steve. Thanks to you guys for listening. I was a bit distracted at the beginning of the, you know, when I was doing the intro, because I don't know if anybody has ever had blocked ears, but my ears have been blocked for like a week and they're actually starting to, you know, I've been putting a little bit of a earwax softener in my ears. I apologize if that's disgusting for people, but I'm at that phase where it's starting to open up, but it kept opening and closing on me the whole time. And so the whole time, I guess because I have earphones in, and every time I move my mouth, it moves my ear. And sometimes it's open and sometimes it's shut, which is still happening now, by the way. So I was trying to, oh, wow, that, see, it just opened up there now. Wow, I can just hear so nice right now, and it'll shut again in a sec. But oh my God, it's like, and it's shut again. It's so weird to have that experience. But when it opens, it's amazing. I really cherish those moments where it opens up a bit. It's so wonderful to hear completely. And I've been dealing with that for a while. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Thanks for listening again. It's great to have the Des Bishop podcast because I love The Shift. And The Shift has really taken off. And, you know, I did this. I have a bit that's gone a bit viral on Facebook this last week. And that's driving a lot of people to The Shift. And hopefully it drives people to the Des Bishop podcast. But anyway, I need the Des Bishop podcast because I need to be able to talk about things like the conversations we just had a bit more serious, not the same pressure to just be funny. I guess the stories behind the jokes sometimes, the stories behind the funny people. And it won't always be comedians, but that's just kind of a convenience a lot of the time in terms of the people that we chat to. Steve's going to be a regular contributor to the podcast. Some of the episodes are just going to be like talking about an issue with a few of our regular contributors just to take the pressure off. And I hope you guys will enjoy that too. I think people used to enjoy just me chatting on my own. And essentially, it's just a version of that, talking about stuff. So I think, let's say Friday is going to be the day. And I'd like this to be like weekend listening. So that there's no, you know, there's no, I mean, it'll be up Friday. You can listen to it on your way home on a Friday, you know, but it's also like chilling at home, maybe a bit of a hangover. It's a bit gentle, you know? So anyway, that's it, guys. Give us 5 stars on iTunes. Obviously, I know that a lot of people unsubscribed because I didn't put up an episode since, you know, I really, it hasn't been regular for a year. So I know a lot of people have unsubscribed. So please subscribe again if you used to subscribe. Tell people that the podcast is back. Give us 5 stars on iTunes. We're on Spotify. It doesn't show up great in the search yet, but I only just put it on Spotify last week. But eventually it will show up well in the search. But I'll be putting swipes on Instagram if you're looking for it on Spotify. You know, obviously the 5 stars and the comments on iTunes really help our positioning on the charts, which is positive for us. But if you listen on Spotify or on the Acast app or on CastBox, any of those sites, Stitcher, please like do a screenshot, put it up on Facebook, put it up on Instagram. Just help to get the word out about the podcast. Anyway, guys, I'm in Clonmel and Tullamore next weekend. If you're in those parts of the world and you want to come see a show, Steve will be with me actually. So if you want to see a bit of the comedy behind the man, behind the serious life, come and check us out next weekend. Clonmel and Tullamore. And then, of course, don't forget Mia Mama Tour on sale now. My Dublin dates are in the Project Arts Center. I think there's some confusion about that. Project Arts Center. Google that. You'll find the ticket link. Or you can go to desbishop.net/tour dates to check that out. So thanks, guys.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.